we get to that point where we had a government, a citizenry, of people who were opposed to war, who were reluctant to go to war, we had a structure which made it difficult to go into war, to a place where we are now, where we go into war at the drop of a hat, we don't have constitutional approval, the president is not held accountable, and I would guess that perhaps the media has something to do with that. So I think Mr. Montgomery will maybe tie that. Thank you.
Thanks very much. First off, I saw some people I recognized from the New York Police Department. Would they please go to a different lecture? You know who you are. I wish that were funny. I like to associate myself with my two colleagues on the panel and my three colleagues on the panel. I'm reminded with respect to impeachment that the only time I got arrested and convicted was when I refused to leave John Conyers' office until he discharged his constitutional duty to begin impeachment proceedings.
Yeah.
Now, I had a little interview with Matt Rothschild yesterday, and I found myself saying that the President of the United States is a fraud. Mm-hmm. Well, so is John Conyers. Mm-hmm. What happens to a person after being one of the leaders of the committee that impeached or almost impeached Nixon, you get sort of comfortable in the accoutrements of power, you have fancy ties, and you think that you don't have to abide by the Constitution of the United States, and he should be impeached as well. And don't buy his stuff about what he's going to do now, because he never follows through and does it. He prepares nice little studies, he's got good people working for him, they love him, but he doesn't fulfill his constitutional duties, and that's big. I guess I probably should explain why I was convicted. There were 100 people, because there are lessons here about who you get arrested with and how you do it. It wasn't my first time, but there were about 100 of us wrapped up there processed, and when they said, if anybody want to go to court, McGovern raised his hand. Ah, this needs to be exposed, right? I looked around all my colleagues, nah. pay the $50. But I was going to go to court. So, long story short, I had an education that I wouldn't replace in a minute. I saw how the U.S. Superior Court treats real criminals, like people, homeless people who are caught drinking a beer in a bag on the street. Drinking in public, they put you in shackles, folks. They put you in shackles. How long does it take a marshal to unlock the shackles? 2 minutes, I timed it 10 times. Those were the offenses, driving with an expired license, that kind of stuff. Now the judge was pretty good. I mean, he was very simple. He was kind, but the marshals, you let those marshals loose on these people, back down to jail after they plead whatever they're going to do. So that was a lesson in and of itself, and it was worth the whole experience. But then a couple of months later, after I was arraigned, I went to trial. You know, the idea is to get people there, you know, to support you and all. I had a couple of people, but I think that was very important. But I had a really neat speech written, okay, about First Amendment rights, okay. And it drew on my Virginian heritage. Well, 50 years in Virginia, that's okay. I mean, really, I'm a New Yorker, okay? Perhaps you could tell by my speech. But, you know, I'm really proud, genuinely proud to be a Virginian, okay? I've learned lots about, you know, James Madison, you know, George Mason. I mean, they live in my neighborhood. George Mason's father was drowned right in the Potomac, about 2 miles from where I live, okay? And I learned more about these people, so I had the speech, and I said, you know, Constitution is important. The Bill of Rights is even more important. You know, James Madison, George Mason, my Virginian forefathers, You know that even though they worked on that Constitution, when it came to the end, James Madison said, "I'm not going to sign it. I don't want anything to do with it." And Madison and Mason said, "Why not?" He said, "Because it doesn't have a Bill of Rights." The judge looked down at me and said, "Mr. McGovern, I think that was Mason that refused to sign it." So it helps to get your facts right, too. That was the only point at which I was glad there was only one of my supporters. He happened to be Episcopalian priest who finally found out which room I was in. He knew that, the virtue, you know, and he had his collar on and everything, and he didn't know about Mason Madison, so it, you know, I escaped. It wasn't on tape or anything. But the lesson is, you don't do things by yourself, okay? I mean, I should have known that, because the first time I got arrested, I was the Catholic workers. I mean, they know how to do this sort of stuff. I learned so much from that arrest. But this time I'm going to do it by my own. And, you know, if you're going to try to do it by your own, try to figure out how the system works and get your facts straight. That will help. I was going to talk today mostly about a couple of things. My own experience with the press. And I probably should tell you that, let me just tell you a couple of direct experiences. When I had a chance to challenge Rumsfeld in Atlanta 5 years ago, using his own words again. As I left the auditorium, I got told in my cell, "Hello?
Hello, Mr. McGovern." Woman's voice. "I'm calling for Paula, and she's very impressed by what you said. She wants to interview."
Now, I don't watch Bush television, okay? Who is Paula? Paula's on.
That's
right.
That's good.
So I said, "Who's Paula?" She said, "Well, Paula's on." I said, "What, she have a local radio station?" I knew who she was, okay? Well, she came on loaded for bear. "Why did you follow the Secretary of Defense down to Atlanta to abuse him like that?" I didn't follow him down. I was here first. I'm getting an award from the ACLU tonight. He followed me down. But the best was, the next call was,
"Mr. McGovern, this is Anderson Cooper."
"That's Anderson."
He says, "Well, I've been watching TV here, and it's quite a remarkable thing. I want to watch you be on my show, but I have to ask you first, weren't you afraid?"
And I said to myself, well, you know, that's easy. Then I thought, wait a second, Anderson Cooper, doesn't he inherit some like $50 million?
Yeah.
And isn't he a big deal on CNN? And he's asking me if I, and so I started, because I'm going to be nasty here, I said, "Well, you know, Anderson, actually it was a big high. You might want to think of trying it sometime. Get your facts in order, ask some real questions."
Well, thank you very much.
Guess what? Knocked off the transcript of that one. Now, John Stewart put together all these reactions I got from the main, what I call the fawning corporate media. It is a riot. Well, he waited a couple days and then he collected all these things. And, you know, it was pretty clear that I was right, but all these commentators were breaking me over the coals for doing this impolite thing. So one person said to me after that, he said, "Well, how did you become famous?" And I said, "Well, number one, I'm reminded of John Kennedy, my idol still, who was asked how he became famous at one point. He says, "I couldn't help it. The Japanese shot out my boat from underneath." So I was thinking, well, I couldn't help it. I asked Rumsfeld some questions and he lied. He had no clothes on. So that was really not what I was going to talk about, and I want to not run over my time here. What I was going to talk about is today's anniversary, which you'll all remember, exactly 9 years ago, the campaign for lies to justify a war against Iraq began officially with a major speech by Dick Cheney, before the Veterans of Foreign Wars, where he said, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, they're working on them, they're close to it, and don't think that UN inspectors, all they'll do is give you a false sense of security, we gotta stop them. That was the opening shot, okay. Now who was there to listen to that? General Zinni, Tony Zinni, Marine, four-star, just back from being head of CENTCOM. He's sitting there, he's getting an award, okay, he retired a year before. And he's listening to this and he says, huh, I wonder where Cheney got that. I'm still on contract. I didn't hear anything like that. I get everything to see, where do you get that? Okay. Now, how do we know that about Zinni? 4 years later, he told us. 4 years later, okay? Now, what did George Tenet say? Well, he reports in his book that he went up to Vice President, no, he didn't go to Vice President Cheney. He went around the White House and said, I wonder where did Dick Cheney get that? And somebody asked George Tenet, well, did you ask the president? He said, no, I didn't think it would be my place to ask the president. George Tenet was the head of the CIA. So that's how bad it is, okay? So that's the anniversary today. You guys probably know the rest of the story, I think. So I'm going to tell you something good. The reason I was disrespectfully making so many notes here is because I'm the beneficiary of a whole bunch of people who look out for me and try to make me informed. That includes analytical points. Some of you know that I've never had an original idea in my life. I always suck ideas from people that I really admire, some of whom you see right up in front of the dais here. Who knows who James Douglas is? Okay, did he write a book recently? What's it called?
The Assassination of John F. Kennedy.
John?
What happened and why it's important.
Right, that's it. Yeah, it's JFK and the Unspeakable.
The Unspeakable.
And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Unspeakable. James Douglas runs a Catholic worker house that he and his wife established in Birmingham, Alabama. Up until he started investigating assassinations, he wrote mostly books about Thomas Burke and other spiritual fathers. He has just finished a book on Gandhi, but his next book is on Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Now, how does Malcolm X fit into all this? Well, Lisa is smiling. What we've seen in the New York Times here, written by these two AP reporters, is reminiscent very much of what happened to Malcolm X. You know why, folks? Because within the New York Police Department, there was a cell from the CIA and from the FBI, and they were following subversive people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and in 1965, they killed him. They shot him. We know the guy who had the shotgun that made Malcolm fall back and hit his head. I was told that if the shotgun didn't kill him, the blow to the head did. The other ones were just pistol shots. It was the FBI and the NYPD and the CIA who did Malcolm in. We know it. There's a book out. The New York Times reviewed the book 1 month ago. And it reveals who this fellow is. One of them is in New York, in Newark now, is a big politico. So what am I saying here? This all happened before, okay? And that's why we had the hearings by Frank Church. And that was fixed for a while until it started to be eroded. And then, of course, as you know, finish the phrase for me, please, folks. After 9/11, everything changed, right? So, whereas before 9/11, Condoleezza Rice, 6 weeks before 9/11, said Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. He's not even a threat to his immediate neighbors. We've kept them from him. 9/11 happens, right? What happens? Weapons of mass destruction float down like manna from the heavens for a soft landing on a country who thinks they own the oil that we're entitled to, Iran. Okay. Give me a break. You don't get weapons of mass destruction in 6 weeks or even 8 weeks. Now, you would think that maybe the fawning corporate media would say, well, gosh, you know, Condoleezza Rice said this on July 29th, and now Cheney and the others are saying on September 15th that they're now they have them, you know? So the whole thing is so corrupt that it's embarrassing. Now, the two fellows who wrote this, the AP fellows, Apuzzo and Goldman, they don't make the connections, okay? They don't make the connection with the bossy, the bossy little CIA, FBI, NYPD, White House cell within the NYPD. But it was there, and that's what did Malcolm X in. Nobody denies this now. It's very much part of the, anybody who's interested, of course, you won't find it in the media. So why is it that no one, well, there's another little, who remembers who Tony Ulasewicz was? Ah, you do, who was he?
He was a guy who was a cop who was involved with the Watergate tale.
Right, yeah, he was a NYPD tough cop, right? And he was involved in all this stuff, right? And after Malcolm X was killed in 65, he hired himself on with Richard Nixon. He's written a book about it, Nixon's Private Eye, Tony Ulasewicz. So those of you who have a touch of gray in your hair who watched the hearings, the Watergate hearings, remember, he was a big star. You know, he's a tough guy from New York. I'm from New York, too. I can speak the language, too. And he made a big impression, okay? Well, he is sort of a microcosmic example of a person who can move very, very fluently between NYPD, the CIA, the FBI, and the White House, okay? You got that now in the NYPD, and I know the guy who's given the job to do it. His name is David Cohen. For a time, I was in a supervisory position, and he had to have some dealings with me. And man, this guy was, talk about sycophant. Since he thought I had some authority over him or might be able to say something to his bosses about his work, he's working on the Japanese economy, okay? The guy was just so oozing, you know, that wonderful thing from My Fair Lady, oozing charm from every pore. He oiled his way across the floor. How dare you! Well, that's the kind of guy who got promoted under Bobby Gates. Bobby Gates worked for me from 1970 to 1972. I know Bobby Gates, okay? These are the guys that get promoted into these positions. And I've since realized, because of my good friend Bob Perry, for whom I write on consortiumnews.com, his dogged pursuit of things like the October surprise, where I am very much convinced by the evidence that the Republicans, Bill Casey, George H.W. Bush, Bobby Gates, persuaded the Iranians not to release the hostages. Not to release the hostages until Ronald Reagan had won the election. It's clear as a bell, folks. That's what happened. So what am I saying? I'm saying that these are the guys that everyone has an interest in protecting, including the mainstream media, so-called, right? And so why was it that George Bush, after Bobby Gates lied through his teeth about Iran-Contra, after his deputy said, well, I told him all about it, but Bobby Gates couldn't remember, why was it that George H.W. Bush insisted that Bobby Gates become head of the CIA? And he did, even though 31 senators voted, unprecedented number of senators voted against the conference. I mean, what do you suppose? Well, because Bobby Gates could be relied upon to do whatever George H.W. Bush wanted, and they could disguise this October surprise, which, you know, is the height of unconstitutionality for our elections. So it's all very incestuous, and I don't want to impinge any more on your time, but I will tell you this, and I'm going to have to go to my computer. I told you that it's been a terrific privilege just by virtue of having begun to speak out over the last 10 years, that I have my own operations center. It's up there, it's called a Mac, okay? And in the morning I come down in my pajamas at 6 o'clock, and by 8 o'clock, not only do I have, you know, the good stuff that people like John Nichols puts out, Lisa, I have stuff that people are thoughtful enough to send me because they know I'll be interested. So it's just like having an operation center like we had at the CIA with a big grocery sort of thing that bring it by 6 times a day. And in those days, some of the younger of you won't realize this, but we actually had inboxes made. They were boxes. They were made out. They were made out of wood. And they used to dump this stuff in 6 times a day. Well, now, you know, I'm up to date at 8 o'clock where I was at 4:30 at the CIA, and I get all kinds of people looking out for me, sending me stuff, and it's, you know, it's very uplifting. And I want to give you an example of that. I already gave you one today. James Douglas, the reason I'm late, he called me about an hour before we went on here and told me, you know, you ought to look at the Malcolm X thing because it's exactly what happened to Malcolm X, what's happening now in the NYPD. David Cohen, the fellow I mentioned before, is one of the people that Bobby Gates let bubble to the top. The same people who were suborned into creating that fraudulent intelligence estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, okay? That's how you do it. I'm gonna read this one little thing from my computer, if I get that, and then I'm gonna stop. It's very, very brief. Thanks. It's a memorandum from the head of the CIA, John McCone, to the head of the Secret Service at the time, James Rowley. Subject: Central Intelligence Report on the Assassination of John Kennedy. In response to the request made by your office on 24 February 1964 for Lee Oswald's activities and assignments on behalf of this agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, there follows a narrative summary of the internal subversive activities of the Oswald subject. I recommend that unless the commission makes a specific request for specific information on this stuff, that we withhold it from it. I won't read anymore. It's terribly damaging. It confirms what James Douglas says in JFK and the Unspeakable, and the reason why the New York Times never reviews this book or never makes these connections is because then you get called what?
Conspiracy.
A conspiracy theorist! And you're ruined, whether you're in academe or you're in journalism. Conspiracy theorists, you know, you can't abide conspiracy theorists. So that's I guess what I would appeal for you to kind of think about. The information is out there. We all know how to get the real information from the web, but nobody else does. That's the problem, is there's a missing link between the information and Americans who are deprived of it. They're malnourished on information. Now, we have the fifth estate, the ether, okay? And we got to figure out better ways to use that thing. Talk to your kids, talk to your grandchildren, as I do, you know. Learn how to, we got to do this better, because we have the tools to do it with now, but I don't know exactly how you make it happen, but it's got to happen. Let me just close by saying what a privilege it's been to be on this panel and to be able to chat with you guys. Thank you.
I know we're right at the end of the time period allotted for this panel. I will take the moderator's privilege of saying a couple things. You know, I organized this panel, and I had in my mind what the topic was about. And some of the thoughts that I had, which I thought were obvious and everybody would talk about, nobody talked about. So I want to say a few things. How many people here, I think probably everybody does realize that the media is owned by just a few, the major media, the fawning corporate media, is owned by 4 or 5 companies, right? Everybody knows that. GE owns Time. GE makes weapons. Time owns, it's all one big thing. So as long as money can be made from war, then it's going to be in the interest of these corporations to keep it going. And the media is now so entrenched in the promotion of war and keeping it rolling that it's just this endless cycle. How many people have seen Barry McCaffrey on MSNBC or CNN, and he's this expert? Well, he's on the board of directors of DynCorp. But he doesn't disclose that. It is in his interest to promote war. And so you never see experts on the mainstream media talk about the futility of war. When was the last time you saw, a Phyllis Bennis or a Ray McGovern or somebody, a John Nichols, talking about this is not in our interest, this is a violation of the Constitution? So it's this endless promotion of the military and the industry and the media, which keeps the whole thing spinning, and they're all one thing. They're all one thing. And so we've got to take everything we see that's on the corporate media with a huge grain of salt, and we must challenge it, and we must say, this is not the way it is. There's no disclosure here. You people are not, there's a conflict of interest, a huge conflict of interest here, and we've got to challenge them on that. So that's one thing I really, really wanted to stress, and nobody mentioned that, and I really think that's important. I know the next panel starts at 11, so as long as you have enough time to get to the next panel, we can take a few questions if you like. But I don't want people to be late for their next panel, so feel free. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to give you an opportunity to vilify in the specific. Back in the 80s, I used to read the New York Times cover to cover every morning, and I could turn on NPR and learn something. Now I listen to the AM news for 5 minutes, and I don't learn anything in NPR. So how did NPR become the nationalist public enemy radio?
Let me take a shot at that, because I left it to the much wiser person to do the usual rap on media. I'm a co-founder of Free Press, which is the country's media reform network. And so I've worked a lot on these issues. But I got to tell you, before I answer your question, one clarification on my previous remarks. I did a Ray McGovern. I'm embarrassed. Because how McGovern got up and confused Mason and Madison? When I was thinking, I hadn't told the story of the Vietnam thing for about 5 years. And I gave the wrong name of the ship. It's the Winchester Victory. Western Virginia, and I was thinking Lexington, but the name of the ship is the Winchester Victory. And if you go look for that one, you will find the story of the wonderful anti-imperialist maritime gang. So in answer to your question very quickly, look, the problem of NPR is one of, it's gonna be different than you think, possibly. It is one of starvation. NPR has been starved by the federal government and largely by state governments around the country. And so its resources are so slim that it now goes out and begs from the corporate sector for money. And this has a huge impact. And I want to emphasize how important this is. Bob McChesney and I wrote a book last year called The Death and Life of American Journalism. And we looked at the numbers from around the world. If you can imagine this, in Slovenia, per person, they spend 75 times what the United States does on public broadcasting. 75 times what we do. That's Slovenia. If you go to Norway, if you go to Sweden, if you go to Denmark, Germany, Great Britain, you will see 50, 60 times as much coming from the Treasury to public broadcasting. We think, we got problems with our government. But all of those countries have figured out, not always, but generally, how to put a firewall, to get that money out and to create a public media that actually communicates, that serves the public interest. We have so starved our public broadcasting that it has become scared and deferent to economic power and military power. And so that's the answer to your question. It is a starvation syndrome. And I'll just close with one quick notion on this too, that that when the Economist magazine does its democracy index, looks at those most small D democratic countries in the world, the exact parallel, the only parallel you will find on a healthy democracy is high spending on public broadcasting by the public sector, not by the private sector.
Yes, ma'am.
To clarify, BBC does not come out of the Treasury.
It comes from the license fee.
People pay $340 a year. Each person with the television pays the citizens.
They pay a license fee.
Yes, so, but that's a main funder for that. And just, I would recommend reading on the weapons of mass destruction and that whole issue. Read the book by Norman Baker, who is a member of Parliament. So many of his constituents came to him and said, David Kelly did not commit suicide. Please look into this. This whole, the coroner and all that, it was all fixed. The person who led the investigation ended up getting an award from the CIA in Virginia after it was all over. And the book is called The Strange Death of David Kelly. And it is phenomenal in what was happening on both sides of the big water that led up to that and the cover-up and so forth.
In the back, sir?
Hi, this is John. Going back to your discussion on debating the war in the Constitution over 2 years, very thinly acclaimed, can you say that the budget would be a discussion of it?
I'm not going to give you a long answer, yes. Yeah. The budget should be, and Ray, especially, I think it gives high marks for having been one of the people, and Veterans for Peace, that have tried to make the budget discussions into votes. Unfortunately, we don't get as many members of Congress as we should.
We're not involved.
And I would just add, one of the things that is happening is we have the Pentagon budget. We then also have a budget that's called the basically the national security budget. That's a separate figure that's, somewhere in the range of $50 billion. These budgets, now that it's spread out through the infrastructure for the war on terror or the global war on terror or whatever the terminology is, in terms of the Al-Qaeda rationale, small amount of Al-Qaeda operatives, not Islamists, generally, small amount. The budget now, those budgets are not part of that debate. They should be part of that debate. The DHS budget should be part of that debate, as well as the FBI and related budgets. And the Center for Media and Democracy is actually working on doing some new material that we have underway on those budget figures, which are essential for the Democratic debate, and we'll be posting those through prwatch.org, which is our publication site.
Okay, let's take one more question, sir.
When you talk about mainstream media, I think we have to not let the small media off the hook too. We have a son who works in the Duluth paper in Minnesota.
Pardon me? It's a good paper, Jim.
Yes, well, it was. But it was taken over by the Forum. They're the only union paper left in that whole organization, and they're breaking the union, and my son happens to be the president of the union, so his life is pure hell for the last 5 years. But he has a hard time being a reporter because they don't want news. They want but we have to remember that small radio stations, small newspapers, everything is under attack. The other thing I would say is, we talk about the internet as this wonderful tool, but it's a little bit of something built on sand. And we have to begin to think past that, because if they're going to close down the internet whenever it gets inconvenient to them. And so we have to do that. One other point I want to say is, you talked about at the end of World War II. I think what happened at the end of World War II is that the capitalists thought they won the war. It wasn't the war for democracy, it was the war for capitalism. And since that time, capitalism and the control of that has been the issue. We've been against every democratic movement across the globe since then.
Mm-hmm. So, sorry we didn't have time for more questions. Thank you for your presence, and don't be late for your